This work is, of course, by no means complete, but I think that there's enough of it that is sort of figured out already to make this worth presenting here. So this new perspective arises from an old perspective, that one being Wilson's perspective on quantum field theory. And so with that in mind, let me give an outline of what I'll be talking about. So ERG here stands for exact renormalization group, and it's the a formulation of Wilson's ideas appropriate to continuum quantum field theory. And so understanding some qualitative aspects of this will form the first part of the talk. Then in the second part, I'll go on to describe the picture of renormalizability that this formalism gives. Then in the final section, this will be where I present, as I said, what I think is this new perspective. I'll be talking about correlation functions and how they arise in the exact renormalization group. So the first question one might have is, what is the exact renormalization group? And I think a nice answer to this is that it's a bit like a microscope with varying resolving power. So we know that our description of physics generally changes with scale, and this is no more high-minded a statement than saying that the universe looks rather different when viewed through a microscope. And a different way of saying that is that the short-distance and long-distance descriptions of physics often differ. And throughout this talk, sort of central to this approach is a notion of going from a short-distance description to a long-distance description by averaging over local patches. And so here's a sort of little graphic to illustrate that. So this is some microscopic description of a system. So these black and white dots could stand, for example, for spins being up or down, for example. Doesn't really matter what they are. There's some degrees of freedom. We're going to take some patches and replace them by an average. So you get a picture, a coarse-grained picture looking something like this. And Cardi, in his book, points out that people like myself can achieve this effect of going from one to the other, much like doing this. So that's what the exact renormalization group is. When should one use this formalism? When is it useful to use this formalism? So this is the diagnostic for when the ERG is of use. And it's of use for a system with a large number of degrees of freedom per correlation length, and generally speaking, for when you have local interactions. So to understand why this is the case, first of all, look at an easy problem where you have no need for the exact renormalization group. And this would be the case where you have a small number of degrees of freedom per correlation length. So here you go. So here's some big system. The correlation length is small, and it's roughly the size here of this box here. And so let's just suppose that there's a few degrees of freedom within this little box. So because I'm supposing that there's only a few degrees of freedom in the box, it should be that it's easy to understand, or at least comparatively easy to understand. And moreover, because the correlation length is small, this subsystem here captures the behavior pretty much of the whole system. And so consequently, putting these two together, roughly speaking, the whole system is easy to understand. Now, the exact RG comes into its own in the opposite regime. So this is where we have a system with a large number of degrees of freedom per correlation length. So, of course, this is the correlation length, and these little blocks are much smaller than it. So what I want to do this time is, as before, again, focus on some small subsystems, but now we know that they don't capture the behavior of the whole system. And this is simply because these subsystems are small compared to the correlation length. But here's the point. If the interactions are local, then we can imagine, if we focus on this patch of four of them, doing some averaging procedure. So we can average over patches like this, so we can replace that block of four with one big patch, if you like. And now the key piece of insight which Wilson had was that you can iterate this procedure. So now we consider patches like that, of this now this bigger characteristic size, and we do the averaging. And you can see that each time we do this, we're building up to an understanding which gets closer and closer to this large correlation length. So this is the essence of the Wilsonian picture of understanding systems with a large number of degrees of freedom per correlation length. So a few practicalities. Well, let's talk about some applications. So the focus of this talk will be applications in quantum field theory, but this has been applied to many other places. So, for example, critical phenomena, and in fact, renormalization in QFT and the understanding of universality in critical phenomena are really two sides of the same coin, and I'll indicate that later. And then it's been applied in a whole load of other areas as well, which I won't say much more about. So what has it actually given us, the application of the exact RG in these contexts? Well, again, for the purpose of this talk, I want to focus on the understanding of renormalization that it's given us, and since it's so easy to include universality in that, I'll tag that on. And another point which I'll just flag but won't go into is that it's a useful practical tool for performing real calculations. So the picture that I've given you so far is perhaps a little misleading, because it seems there's no catches here, and this can solve everything for you. Of course, that's not the case. And this coarse graining procedure can't, generally speaking, be done exactly. Now, if you're in the happy situation where there's small parameter available, you can do perturbation theory, but you haven't really gained anything from using exact RG in that case. And indeed, for many problems, you have it such that there isn't a small parameter. And one of the nice things about the exact RG is that it supports non-perturbative approximation schemes. Now, one can worry about how reliable these are and so forth, but at least it gives you a framework where you can do this. So I'm not going to focus on this in my talk. I'm going to be talking about this and some exact statements that one can make, but I think it's worth flagging. So I now want to return to this notion of going from a microscopic description to a macroscopic description through some blocking procedure and be a little bit more precise about this. So it's useful to consider a lattice example here, so a lattice of spins. So I've got my spins pointing either up or down, one per site, of course. And to go from microscopic to macroscopic, as I've said, I'm going to average over groups of spins. And for argument's sake, I'm going to choose 3x3 blocks. And that's an arbitrary choice, which will be important later, but let me suppose that I've done it. So if I look at this block here, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 spins pointing up and 4 pointing down, and if I use a majority rules prescription, for example, then I'd replace this block with one big up spin, one macroscopic spin, if you like. And then I go through and do it for the next one, and so forth. Now, in doing this procedure, you can see that the lattice spacing has effectively increased by a factor of 3. And so I want to now rescale this back to the original lattice spacing. So one thing I should add to this, I just showed this portion of the lattice here. Let me suppose that the entire thing is much bigger than I could have originally drawn. So when I do the rescaling, it's going to suck in some bits that weren't previously on my transparencies. So here we go. I do the rescaling. And so the block that was on the previous one is now just this one down here, and all these other ones have been drawn in from outside the picture. And the exact RG implements the continuous version of this blocking. So rather than considering scale changes in the scale factor by factors of 3 or 5 or whatever you like, this is some infinitesimal variation in the scale. So an obvious question is, what is the effect of this blocking procedure, or this procedure of blocking and rescaling? And let's just suppose, going back to the the lattice example we had on the previous transparency, that for argument's sake, the spins happen to interact, the microscopic spins interact only through nearest neighbor interactions. This is just some choice we'll make. And what we find is, after doing one of these blocking transformations, that these new spins exhibit all possible interactions. And so as we iterate this procedure, all these, the strengths of these various interactions are going to change. And so there's a nice way to visualize this, and I'll put a little cartoon up on the next transparency. But first of all, consider the space of all possible interactions. So you might have your nearest neighbor interaction along one axis, and of course, if you're a long way along here, you've got a strong interaction, the next to nearest neighbor interaction along another axis, and so on and so forth. So of course, each point in the space represents some value for all of these various interactions. And as we block and rescale, we're going to hop around. And one of the most important aspects of this, for this talk, is that the transformation, this blocking and rescaling, can have fixed points. And these fixed points play a central role in renormalization in quantum field theory, and also in universality and critical phenomena, and will be central to the extension I want to make of this picture in the final part of my talk. So here's a little graphic illustrating that. So this black dot in the middle is a fixed point, and you can see that I've got some surface that I've indicated here called the critical surface. And this is defined such that trajectories in the critical surface flow into the fixed point. So this notion of going from microscopic to macroscopic is like going from ultraviolet to infrared. So these arrows indicate ultraviolet to infrared. And as I said, if I'm in the critical surface, then I will flow into this fixed point. And the critical surface, it said it's spanned by the irrelevant operator. And they're called irrelevant because they're getting smaller as you get closer to the fixed point. So the irrelevant operators give you the distance from the fixed point, if you like, in the critical surface. And these become less important as I go to the infrared. Conversely, flows along the relevant directions leave the critical surface. And there's a nice sort of piece of insight that, again, Cardi puts in his book, that if there are n relevant directions, we have to tune n quantities to get the critical surface. So you can imagine a practical example. Suppose you've got a lump of ferromagnet, and you want to bring it to its second-order phase transition. It turns out there's two relevant variables in that case, the magnetic field, external magnetic field, and the temperature. So you tune your magnetic field to zero, then you have to very, very precisely adjust your temperature doing that procedure would draw you onto this critical surface, and then the infrared dynamics would be described by the fixed point. And already, in fact, this is sufficient to understand universality of second-order phase transitions. These fixed points describe scale-invariant systems. That's what you see at second-order phase transitions. And you can see that you can reach these fixed points from very different microscopic descriptions. Or to put it another way, you can have two systems with wildly different microscopic behavior, which exhibit in the vicinity of the second-order phase transitions the same universal long-distance physics. So to make this a little bit more concrete now, in preparation for the rest of the talk, let me introduce the Wilsonian effect of action. So we want to start with a partition function, and I've got some field phi, and this lambda zero here is to be interpreted as my bare scale. So, of course, it's some high energy or short distance scale, and everything above this scale is cut off or regularized. So in my first example, it would be somewhat equivalent to my original lattice spacing. And this is the bare or classical action. So this summarizes the interactions we have in our bare theory. So again, in my lattice example, this would say, for example, that I have nearest neighbor interactions if that's my model that I choose, or it could be some other thing. And now what we're doing is we're integrating out modes between this bare scale up here and some lower effective scale. This is the process of coarse graining that we're doing. And a key requirement is that under this process, the partition function doesn't change. The partition function must be invariant, so the physics stays the same, but the description of the physics can change. The physics itself must be invariant. Now, these two expressions have basically the same form, modulo the lambda, and we know that the effects of the high-energy modes have to be taken into account. So for this equality to hold, it must generally, or usually is the case, that the Wilsonian effect of action here, so the action has evolved into some S lambda. So my bare action has changed into S lambda, and it's this that's the Wilsonian effect of action. And this is no different from these flows in parameter space. I start with some bare action, I do my procedure of blocking and rescaling, my flow around, the action changes, and this evolving action is my Wilsonian effect of action. So we can use that now to actually write down some exact renormalization group equations, and I don't need to give any specific forms of these equations for this talk, so I'm just going to show in principle how you can derive these and how this derivation is related to this blocking transformation. So let me just write this down, this expression here, and I claim that this corresponds to a large class of general exact RGs. I'll explain why in a second. So first we'll remember that lambda is my effective scale. So actually, maybe I'll just put this up on the board here. So I've got my energy scale here. I start out with my bare scale, and I integrate down to some effective scale. My phi, as I said before, is just some fields or set of fields. And S, or S lambda, is my Wilsonian effect of action. And the point about writing the expression in this form with this total derivative here is that the partition function is invariant under the flow. And you can see that if I integrate over d phi on both sides, then on this side I have lambda d lambda, the partition function, and on this side I have the integral of a total derivative, which gives me zero. So by construction, this will give me flow equations for which the partition function is invariant. And this object psi parameterizes the particular blocking procedure. So with my example on the lattice, I said that I'd chosen blocks of 3x3 spins for argument's sake. I could have chosen blocks of some other size or some other shape. As long as my procedure leaves the partition function invariant, I'm free to choose essentially what I like. And this encodes this freedom. We can adapt this to suit our needs. And one thing that I want to flag here, which will be useful for later, is that one can think of psi as implementing some field redefinition. So what I mean by that is as you change lambda to lambda minus delta lambda, the effect of this is essentially just a local field redefinition. Anyway, I can expand this out now, so I can allow the lambda to lambda hit the e to the minus s. I can allow the d by d phi to hit the stuff here, and I'll just get some equation that tells me that the flow of s is equal to something. And essentially, that's all I'll need for this talk. Flow of s is equal to something. Now, that's not quite the end of the story, because again, going back to the lattice example, I had two steps to this procedure. First of all, I blocked. I went from sort of lattice spacing A to 3A, had my big spins from my small spins, and then I rescaled everything back down to the original size. So I need to implement this in the current context. I want to do the rescaling. And in this continuum formulation, there's just a very convenient way to do this, and this is to measure all dimensional quantities in units of lambda, where I need to remember to take account of any anomalous dimensions. So just to give an example of how this works, So for example, I might have d4x, phi of x. So I've got a mass term here. So I'm going to shift phi of x goes to phi of x times lambda, so that this is now dimensionless. I've got x goes to x over lambda. And you can see that when I do this, I'm going to basically pick up a lambda squared here, and so my dimensionful mass has been converted into something dimensionless. So that's all I mean by this. So I want to write everything in dimensionless variables using lambda. And just some notation for later, so because I'm going to use both dimensionless and dimensionful fields later in the talk for various different purposes. And so we have dimensionful is phi, and dimensionless is my curly phi. Oh, and one other thing, it's traditional to replace lambda with t, where t is just the logarithm of lambda. And this plays the role of the RG time. So t starts out at minus infinity in the deep ultraviolet. If you hit a fixed point, it flows through, it increases to plus infinity in infrared. So as I've emphasized, all we really need for this talk is that the ERG equation takes the following form. Dt of s is equal to something, the something not being particularly important. And that these fixed points, which I mentioned, are encoded in this condition here, that the action itself is just independent of scale. So fixed points correspond to scale invariant theories. So there are a few bits of terminology that I want to introduce now. So, for example, those of relevance and irrelevance, which I suppose I've mentioned already, but I can go into a little bit more detail. So let me recall the picture that I had here. Some theory space, and I find some critical fixed point. Now I want to perturb slightly away from it and find out whether the resulting perturbations grow or whether they shrink. So we have the first order classification that operators which grow with t are relevant. So those are the ones which came out along here. Operators that shrink with t were irrelevant. Those are the ones that went in there. And operators that stay the same at leading order are the marginal operators. So here you can say that if you perturb a fixed point as so, it's a fixed point up to order a squared, where a is just a small parameter, and this might not be true beyond leading order. The familiar example is the four-point coupling in scalar field theory, d equals 4, is marginally irrelevant. It's quite interesting, actually, that you generically find at least one exactly marginal operator, and these generate lines of fixed points. So you get the following picture here. So you can start out at some fixed point, you linearize your transformation, you find a marginal operator, you can essentially integrate this along to create some line of equivalent fixed points like this. Right, so that's the sort of concludes the qualitative aspects of the exact RG that I wanted to flesh out. And now I want to go into a bit more detail about the understanding it gives one of renormalizability. And of course, this is building toward the final part here. So let me start out with textbook renormalization, because, in fact, one of the main lessons of the final part comes from understanding the relationship between the textbook approach and the Wilsonian approach, or at least a particular aspect thereof. So what we would do is we would choose some action. Let's suppose this, for example. Then we choose a UV regulator. And then we start computing correlation functions. And as we know, we generically expect to find ultraviolet divergences. And so now we start tuning our initial choice of action as so to absorb these ultraviolet divergences. And if we can do this with delta S having the same form as S, then the theory is renormalizable. So the Wilsonian approach is rather different in philosophy. So we pose the following question. So are there any effective actions, so this is after we've integrated out degrees of freedom, for which we can safely send the bare scale to infinity? So the simplest answer. So first of all, recall that all quantities have been rescaled using lambda. So only dimensionless variables appear. So that was as in this case here, or equivalently, if you had an instance of the bare scale appearing, it would have to occur now in this form. And fixed points of the exact RG correspond to renormalizable theories or continuum limits. So this is the fixed point criterion. And the point is recall that this fixed point picks out a few scale-invariant theories. So if S is scale-invariant, or it's independent of scales, lambda-naught is a scale that can't depend on lambda-naught. If it doesn't depend on lambda naught, you can send it to infinity. And essentially, a different way of saying the same thing is that the interesting fixed points basically correspond to conformal field theories. And from conformal field theories, of course, there's no scale. You can send any bare scale to infinity. So that's not the end of the story. So that described for me renormalizable scale invariant theories. We now want to use this formalism to describe scale dependent renormalizable theories. And so we go back to this picture here. So here's my fixed point. And now I want to consider this blue trajectory here. So you can see it's just off the critical surface. So it will go towards the fixed point for a while, and then it will shoot off along the red relevant direction. I want to do two things. I want to tune it like so towards the critical surface while sending the bare scale to infinity. And when I do that, the trajectory splits in two. So I have this part here sinking into the fixed point, and this part here emanating out, which is what will occupy us for the rest of the talk. And the actions along this trajectory are renormalizable. And this is one of Wilson's so-called renormalized trajectories. It's easy enough to demonstrate this, but it's even easier to understand intuitively why it has to be the case. So renormalization is a property of the ultraviolet. The ultraviolet is controlled by a fixed point. We've already argued that fixed points correspond to renormalizable theories. So it's very plausible that this is true. Anyway, what's the key point of all of this? It's as follows, that non-perturbatively renormalizable theories follow from fixed points. And they do this in one of two ways. Either directly, you're sitting at the fixed point, or from the renormalized trajectories emanating from them. So let me just remove this now. So for this talk, that's what I'm concerned with. Either theory sitting there, or theory sitting somewhere here. And so this leads us to the notion of theory space. So quantum field theory should be understood in terms of theory space. So this is just this space of all the possible interactions. You want to find, within this space, you want to find what the fixed points are, what the trajectories are coming out from them. This gives you a complete classification of the renormalizability properties of the theory. And the other thing is that renormalizable QFTs follow from the solution to an equation. So I have this exact renormalization group equation. I have a criterion, fixed points, or the perturbations coming out of them. I solve an equation to find these. So, sure.
The possibility you're excluding here, since you're essentially assuming the renormalizable theories have a given fixed point, is a trajectory in which, without hitting a fixed point, it nevertheless doesn't have a lambda pole or anything like that.
So, yes.
But stays continually.
So I am excluding things like that. So they're not just. Exactly, so limit cycles or other exotic behavior. So it is possible, although it would seem unlikely, certainly for scalar field theory, that such things exist. So, for example, in the most reliable non-perturbative approximation scheme, if you like, you can show at lowest order that these things don't occur. It might be that they occur at higher order, it might be that they occur for other theories. That's fine if they do. I'm just going to focus on this,
that's fine.
This particular realization, but yes.
That's why I'm going
to make. Oh, no, absolutely, yeah. Yes, yeah, so I'm just presuming that this is the end of the story in that regard. So this is what I will analyze. So once you have this understanding of theory space, there are a few, again, bits of terminology that one can use that are useful.
This is asymptotic freedom, asymptotic safety, and so forth. So let me just illustrate these. The first, the simplest and least interesting, is triviality. So this is where, in the whole of theory space, you've just got one fixed point, and it's the Gaussian one. And it turns out that you're in such dimensions that you have no interacting relevant directions. And so the only non-perturbatively renormalizable theory you can construct is just a massive trivial theory. And so the theory space suffers from the so-called triviality problem. So more interesting is where you have asymptotic freedom. And of course, this is where, again, you've got a Gaussian fixed point. But here you have some interacting relevant directions. So you can perturb the Gaussian fixed point in an interesting direction. You end up with an interacting renormalizable theory like QCD, for example. And the final one that fits into this classification is asymptotic safety. So ignore what's going on down here for the moment. So this is where you've got some non-trivial fixed point, which has an interesting direction coming out of it. And so you can construct renormalizable theories about this. Now, just suppose for argument's sake, I mean, these trajectories could be going anywhere, but just suppose that one of these trajectories happens to close past the pass close to the Gaussian fixed point here. So given that, look at the theory in this regime here. It's close to the Gaussian fixed point, so you can do perturbation theory. What would you conclude? Well, you conclude that the theory isn't renormalizable because you're doing perturbation theory in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point, and the trajectory isn't coming out of the Gaussian fixed point. But that conclusion is actually wrong in this case, because renormalizability here is really determined by some other fixed point up in the ultraviolet. In other words, you're trying to conclude things about the wrong point. And this is the idea behind some active work at the moment into quantum gravity, where some people think that perhaps you could renormalize quantum gravity about some non-trivial fixed point as so. So let me give some examples then of the various different classifications I just gave. So take scalar field theory in four dimensions. So it seems that only the Gaussian fixed point exists, so this isn't proven, but it's almost certainly true. Let's just suppose for argument's sake that it is true. Now this is certainly true, the mass is relevant. The four-point coupling is marginally irrelevant, and everything else is just plain irrelevant. So therefore, because you've only got one fixed point, the Gaussian one, you've only got non-interacting relevant directions, the only non-perturbatively renormalizable scalar field theories in four dimensions are trivial. So the perturbative conclusions are different from this, but non-perturbatively, you find this rather sad state of affairs. The situation is rather different when you go to three dimensions. So again, you have the Gaussian fixed point. Again, the mass term is relevant. But here you find that the four-point coupling is also relevant. And so now you can make a perturbation along this direction, which is interacting. And so you get non-trivial, renormalizable theories along this lambda pi to the four direction. And moreover, there's another fixed point which exists in theory space, the so-called Wilson-Fischer fixed point. It just so happens that this also possesses a relevant direction, so you could use that to construct some theory as well. And just to give an example then, you might have the following flow in four dimensions. This one exists. You could start at the Gaussian fixed point. You could perturb it in its lambda phi to the four direction. If you tune it precisely, you can actually end up hitting the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. You needn't do this, but this is just an example of a continuum limit that happens to exist in three dimensions. Right, so I started out this section by mentioning some elements, if you like, of the textbook approach to renormalization. And I now want to compare this to the Wilsonian approach, or in a very specific way, and this will lead on to the final part of the talk. And the question is, what is the link? And I want to answer this in a specific aspect of this question. In particular, the textbook formulation of renormalization is in terms of correlation functions, whereas the Wilsonian formulation is in terms of the Wilsonian effect of action. And my aim for the rest of this talk is essentially to convince you that understanding this question, or that the question itself, is a profound one. Oops. So with that in mind, I now want to move on to discuss correlation functions in the exact RG. And hopefully convince you that this discussion does lead to something which I believe constitutes a new perspective on certain aspects of QFT. So let me now actually say something about the particular exact renormalization group equations that are useful in this case. So there's a famous one due to Polchinski. And again, I'm not going to bother to write it down because the specific form doesn't really tell us anything useful. But there's an equation. Polchinski wrote it down. It's a nice equation to use. And you do it by choosing this blocking functional to take a particular form. So what are the pros of his flow equation? Well, it's simple. And also, the correlation functions can be extracted from the low energy limit of the effective action. So it seems in this sense that the question as to the relationship between the renormalizability of the effective action and the renormalizability of the correlation functions is trivial. Because if you use this flow equation, the action from the action, you can extract the correlation functions, and so it seems there's no more to it. However, the con for using the Polchinski equation is that it's inconvenient for finding fixed points. So with that in mind, let me take a different flow equation that's better adapted for finding fixed points. So what you want to do is recall that this psi could be thought of as corresponding to some field redefinition. So then let me add a little bit to it. So I'm going to take the same choice as Polchinski, but I'm going to allow for an extra field redefinition along the flow. And I'm going to choose it as follows. So I'm going to take psi to be linear in the field. The coefficient up, well, it's minus half, doesn't matter, but this eta is basically the anomalous dimension of the field, defined as follows. And so what you're doing is you're going to choose this field redefinition to ensure canonical normalization of the kinetic term. So you can imagine you start off here, you start to flow, and the flow would like to generate for you a non-canonical kinetic term, but you can then correct for this, you can remove it with your extra field redefinition. So you always insist the kinetic term just has canonical normalization. Or a different way of putting this, the redundant coupling, or the inessential coupling, as some people would call it, Z, is removed from the action. So the pros, it turns out that by taking account of the anomalous dimension in this way, it becomes much easier to find fixed points with non-vanishing anomalous dimension. Those are essentially all the interesting ones anyway. So this is much better to use than the plain Polchinski equation, for finding fixed points. But the con is that the link between the action and the correlation function changes. So this link that the correlation functions follow from the low energy limit of the action, the true for the Polchinski equation, we've changed the equation, so the link has to change as well. And so now we need to understand that. So as one usually does in textbook formulation, I want to introduce a source now. So just to recall what's done in the standard case. So usually we just introduce the source term. So let's say for argument's sake, j dot phi, the level of the bare action. And now we extract the connected correlation functions from W by taking functional derivatives with respect to J and setting J to zero. And you needn't consider just the plain field here. You can do composite operators, so I can add in a source term, let's say for phi squared, take derivatives with respect to J and J2 and get these mixed objects here. And then once I've done this, I have to analyze the renormalization properties. So what I'd like to propose is a completely different way of doing this, essentially doing things in reverse order. So what I want to do is I want to introduce an external field, and I'll call it J. So obviously J is going to be identified with a source, but for the time being I just want to say it's some external field. And it's going to have some undetermined scaling dimension. So what I mean by that is remember that I went from dimension full to dimensionless variables. I had to multiply by the appropriate power of lambda. What I'm saying is I don't yet know what that power of lambda is. I know that it's something, but I haven't fixed it yet. And now I'm simply going to say that my action can depend on J in some arbitrary manner. So it will be fixed later, but for the time being, S can just be some function of phi and J. And my flow equation just follows exactly as before. So I still have the requirement that my partition function is invariant under the flow, but now my S can depend on phi and J. Fine. So what would a sensible boundary condition be? Well, a sensible boundary condition would be that if I just look at the source-dependent part of my source-dependent action, then it reduces to J dot phi in the ultraviolet. This would correspond to the standard correlation functions. But a crucial part of what follows is that I'm not going to implement the boundary condition in this way. So what I am going to do is as follows. So the game is to instead search for renormalizable solutions, but now solutions which depend on the source. So how do I do this? Well, it's exactly as before. I'm going to search for fixed points and the perturbations coming out of them. So I have this condition. I either want to find, well, first of all, I want to find these fixed point solutions. So that's this guy, but where now this corresponds to some T star of phi and J. Or from the source-dependent perturbation. So again, this is some perturbation, but now it depends on both phi and J. And so the notation, let me just note that I've got some more dimension full and dimensionless quantities. So capital J is dimension full, and little j is dimensionless. Right, so it turns out that one can find source-dependent fixed points, or a certain class of them, very readily. So suppose that I've already found some standard fixed point, some one which just depends on the normal field and not the external one. Then you can show that there's always a particular source-dependent extension of it that takes the following form. So just to highlight the notation, it's not particularly important, but okay, so j bar is j over p squared. I've got some functions of p squared here. I said the form doesn't really matter. What does matter is that there's two crucial points that this solution has. So the first is the solution only works if dj, so this undetermined scaling dimension of the external field, is fixed to a very particular value. And the second thing is that having found the solution, if we then transfer to dimension full variables and look what happens in the ultraviolet, we find that this reduces to j dot phi. But the point about this is this has come about, this is an output of the approach, not an input. So we haven't said at the start, I'm going to put j dot phi in and see whether my correlation functions are renormalizable. What we said instead, I'm going to find source-dependent renormalizable solutions. I'm then going to figure out after I've done this which correlation functions they correspond to. So there's a little bit more. So if we recall when I discussed these notions of relevance and irrelevance, I said for each critical fixed point, you can find the eigenperturbations. So this is just my linearization around the fixed point. And so these alphas are some constants. The O's are the operators, and lambdas are my eigenvalues. So what I mean by that, if the lambdas are positive, these are my relevant directions, because if lambda is positive, this guy increases with increasing t. This is relevant. If the lambdas were negative, these would be irrelevant ones. And if lambda were zero, these are the marginal ones. So this is a general form the action perturbed in the vicinity of the fixed point, so somewhere just in the neighborhood round here. And the point is that just as every fixed point has a source-dependent extension, so too does every eigenperturbation. So this guy here, this O tilde, is generated from my standard eigenperturbation, again, by this operator involving basically J d by d phi. So in the source-dependent case, I can do a similar thing here. So I'm going to take some perturbation. So I'm going to start at my T star. I'm going to make some perturbation. And a priori, I don't know whether these lambda tildes are going to be the same as the lambdas. But it turns out, and you can check this, they do indeed come out to be the same. So what this tells you then is that I found every fixed point has a particular source-dependent extension, and every trajectory, every perturbation has a source-dependent extension, which in particular means that every renormalized trajectory has a source-dependent extension. So what's the interpretation of this? So these are the bits that I've just said. Oh, and let me add the final thing. I've also mentioned that in dimensionful variables, you find that it reduces to J dot phi in the ultraviolet. So our conclusion is that if I use now the modified Polchinski equation, then renormalizability of the action implies renormalizability of the standard correlation functions. And that's just because these solutions here, they're renormalizable by construction, they correspond to fixed points or trajectories coming out of them, generate for you a J dot phi term in the ultraviolet, which gives you the standard correlation functions. So this result is not surprising. Right, we knew that renormalizability of S lambda gave renormalizability of the correlation functions in the Polchinski case. What is surprising, as I say, that you find this coming as an output and not an input. So does this really constitute a new perspective? So to argue that it does, let me compare the two approaches, the standard approach and the new approach. So first of all, in the textbook approach, you decide which correlation functions to compute, i.e., do you want just correlators of the fundamental fields, or do you want composite operators, or whatever? So I say instead, just allow for arbitrary source dependence of your action. So returning to this column here, what you next do is you introduce an appropriate source term to generate these correlation functions. And I say instead, search for fixed point solutions. So now finally, in the textbook approach, having done this, you now need to analyze the renormalizability of the correlation functions. Now in this case here, renormalizability is guaranteed for you because this is what you've searched for. So now what you need to do instead is you need to deduce the correlation functions to which your solutions correspond. So the philosophy to this, and this isn't surprising, this first part, I suppose, is that the Wilsonian effect of action in terms of renormalizability is fundamental. In other words, this is the object to consider with regards to renormalization. Then you can derive from this renormalizability of other things, such as correlation functions. But in some sense, this has a primary status with regards to renormalizability. That, I said, is not particularly surprising from the Wilsonian picture. I think what is surprising, as I've emphasized quite a few times now, is that in the sense which I've made precise here, quantum field theory is actually determining for you which quantities you can compute. We didn't put the J dot phi in by hand. This came out, if you like, the quantum field theory telling us that we should be looking at these correlation functions. So this leads now to a number of questions. So let me start off by sticking with this modified Polchinski equation that I've been using in this talk. So I found one particular class of renormalizable solution, one particular class of source-dependent renormalizable solution. And so we might well ask, do others exist? And so there are a number of things which this leads on to. So maybe let me just come around here to the clean part of the board. So in your standard case, you've got some theory space where you can imagine that there's maybe some fixed points that live at various different points. And within this approach here, what you're doing is you're looking at a single fixed point, let's say this one, and you're looking at the source-dependent perturbations thereof. So an obvious question, I think, which manifests itself is, do the source-dependent perturbations of this fixed point know about just local properties of theory space, for example, or do they actually know about the complete properties of the standard theory space? And it's not such a crazy question to ask, because you can imagine, let's suppose you're looking at the Gaussian fixed point, and you want to know maybe whether phi to the 4, a J phi to the 4 term exists. Well, you kind of speculate that maybe it might in less than 4 dimensions, but not in 4 dimensions itself. If that's true, it would tell you that somehow the source-dependent extensions of one fixed point know about global properties of theory space. But that's just a speculation, but I think sort of an obvious one to make based on this picture. So, the other thing I should say, of course, is what would these other renormalizable source-dependent solutions correspond to? Well, they correspond to renormalizable composite operators, or composite operators which you could renormalize an arbitrary number of insertions. So this suggests that the operator product expansion plays a role. I suspect that it must do. I don't know how it does. And I think it's very natural to try and make a link with the methods here to conformal field theory. After all, conformal field theory, a lot is known about, tells you a lot about the renormalization properties of correlation functions, which is essentially what I'm trying to do here. So I suspect that there must be, hopefully is rather, some link between the two. So as I said, I focused on the Polchinski equation with a particular modification. Of course, you can make other modifications as long as they fulfill your requirements that you know, you're blocking over local patches, anything goes. And so you'd like to know what happens for other flow equations. So if I perturb my modified Polchinski equation, do the source-dependent solutions continue to exist? They exist within some domain. Do they die completely? Do some exist and some not? This is a question that's interesting to answer, and I think it's particularly interesting from the point of view of gauge theory, because for the implementations of gauge theory, which I'll discuss in just a moment, you're forced to take something more complicated than the Polchinski equation, or than the modified Polchinski equation. So getting a handle on this question in scalar field theory, where it's comparatively tractable, might give you some way of assessing these this question in gauge theory. So let me now just finish off my talk by saying a few words, and just a few, about what this picture implies for gauge theories. So it turns out, and I'm just simply going to state this, I'm not going to go into any detail, but it's possible to construct the gauge invariant cutoff. And so, of course, this is the ideal way you want to do this in the exact logic. You want some cutoff. That's sort of the essence of the whole approach. And a naive implementation of a cutoff will violate gauge invariance, but you can fix this using two ingredients. You can put in covariant higher derivatives. So what that looks like is essentially your F mu nu term gets replaced by something like this. C is a cutoff function, the usual covariant derivative. So you have some replacement like that. You find that this almost regularizes your theory, but that a set of one-loop divergences slip through. And you can cure these by putting in a set of Pauli-Villars fields. Anyway, I don't want to go into details too much. I just hope you believe me for the time being that you can construct the gauge invariant cutoff. Well, once you've constructed the gauge invariant cutoff, you can then start to construct exact renormalization groups. And one of the very interesting things is that you can choose psi, this blocking functional, to give a manifestly gauge invariant flow equation. In other words, a flow equation for which you don't have to fix the gauge at any stage. Now, it would be remiss of me not to mention a big caveat for all of this, that the formalism is very complicated. So it's not just a simple matter of saying, I've done this work in scalar field theory, which seems to work quite nicely. I've got a manifestly gauge invariant flow equation, therefore everything just goes through trivially. It's going to be very difficult to actually figure out how to do this because of the complications of the formalism. But nevertheless, one can see that there are potentially some interesting questions to answer here just from the very existence of such a structure. So if one looks at the correlation functions, if we have manifest gauge invariance, then the standard correlation functions have no role to play. So if you have A of x1, A of x2, and so forth, these are not manifestly gauge invariant objects. So instead, you need to consider correlation functions of manifestly gauge invariant operators. And you want to know how these renormalize, and you want to know, ideally, how these renormalize non-perturbatively. This isn't such an unreasonable request, because if you recall the standard Wilsonian picture of quantum field theory, how do theories renormalize non-perturbatively? Well, you've got a very intuitive answer to this. You say either they're fixed-point theories, or they're on trajectories coming out of fixed points. And it would be very nice to have some equally intuitive understanding of how gauge invariant operators renormalize non-perturbatively. And the essence of what I'm saying is, the essence of the approach, if we follow what we've done in scalar field theory, is rather than trying to, out of the huge number of gauge invariant operators we could write down, say, well, maybe we'll look at this one and see what its renormalization properties are and so forth, we say we can simply throw in some sources and let the exact renormalization group tell us, by solving it, which are the which correlation functions these solutions correspond to. So just to reiterate, you put the sources in, you solve to find renormalizable source-dependent solutions, you take the scale back up to infinity, then you deduce after you've done this which operators it is that you're thinking about. So rather than giving a conclusion, because, as I said, this is very much work in progress, I think I will just finish with a little soundbite, albeit a rather facetious one, which I think summarizes the approach that I'm taking. So anyway, thank you very much for your attention.
So... give some hope that you could have tackled the problem of computing the renormalization of Wilson loops?
Well, that's a very natural thing to try to do, yes, exactly. So it's one of the sort of pitches at the moment of the Wilsonian approach in some sense, that if you just look at the theory of Yang-Mills before you start computing expectation values, you can say, ah, I have renormalizability simply by sitting at a fixed point or flowing out, as you do in Yang-Mills along the F-squared direction. So then you start coming to compute expectation values, and you say the Wilson loop is an obvious thing to do, and you have to do the standard perturbative block. You have to do the standard analysis, which is anyway perturbative in nature and quite fiddly to determine whether these guys are renormalized. Well, not if you find that the cusps need to be renormalized and so forth. It would be lovely to try to apply this in that case, in that sort of scenario. But the one thing that I would say is that rather than putting the Wilson loops in and assessing the renormalization, you hope that they come out naturally as objects in this. So you put your sources in, you hope that the renormalizable solutions tell you that you should be coupling Wilson loops in the ultraviolet. You put the source in, find the solutions, run back up to the ultraviolet and see what it is you should have put in there in the first place. It kind of runs in reverse. You don't know beforehand which operators you're going to be considering, but it would be very natural to suppose that the Wilson loops would be the ones that come out.
Yes, I have a comment on that, and then the question goes in a different direction. That sounds very nice, but a Wilson loop is an infinite order complicated thing if you started just writing down expressions in local operator products and fields.
Yes.
So I would be overawed if you just didn't put anything in and then discovered that Wilson loops were there.
Yes, so that's a very good point, actually. I mean, so something I've glossed over here is that, yes, locality is an important thing for this, and I can't give a good answer to that, to your question, but let me just highlight where the problem arises. So, so what I say is, I say that when I throw in my sources, I look for source-dependent renormalizable solutions, but I've got, at least in the scalar field theory, an additional caveat on top of that, and that is that I demand locality, or that my solutions are sufficiently local, and this is in some sense part of my boundary condition. Now it's clear that if I want to uncover Wilson loops in this approach, I'm going to need to figure out what my boundary condition is, and it's presumably going to violate that. And so that is unquestionably a challenge for this. I'd say I'm still at the stage, unfortunately, where because of the complications of the gauge theory thing, I have in mind that these problems might arise at some point, but I'm still at the stage of just trying to see through the thicket of complication in the formalism itself, never mind the questions like the one you raised. But yes, it's a good question.
Okay, so I have two very conceptual questions, or the whole thing. One of them is in two dimensions where there's a lot known, one plus one dimensions. Being at a fixed point comes with a lot extra that one gets not just scale invariance, but conformal invariance, mm-hmm. which is local scale invariance.
Sure.
And it would be nice to know, I mean, thinking about quantum gravity, it would be nice to know if there was some principle or some strong result that told us that fixed points should actually be locally scale invariant in the gravitational theory and not just globally scale invariant.
I see what you mean. Yes, I mean, to some extent I flag that this is something which I would like to think about in the sense of making a link between this and conformal field theory. I mean, it seems to be, there's certainly no proof of this, but it's just sort of generally the case from experience with the exact RG that all the interesting fixed points which are known in any dimension do correspond to conformal fixed points.
Right, I can remember an early paper of Polyakov I remember studying as a graduate student in which he just made the statement that locality plus fixed points of renormalization groups will be local scale invariant. It's very seductive.
In two dimensions.
It was actually a paper about 2+1 dimensions.
Okay.
And the Wilson Fisher fixed point, I think. But anyway, I just throw that. Let me throw out something else.
Mm-hmm.
It just occurs to me whenever I hear a general talk about this. We always draw these pictures as if fixed points are very scarce.
Yes.
They're sort of, you know,
yes.
In any theory space you expect, you know, Gaussian one and maybe one non-trivial fixed point. But is there actually a reason to believe that?
Yes, there is a reason. So, you know, fixed points are characterized by the anomalous dimension eta star. And something which has been suspected for many years, and which, in fact, I've proved recently, is that certainly in scalar field theory, the spectrum of eta star is necessarily quantized.
Mm-hmm.
So
Now, that means you, it doesn't necessarily mean that the spectrum of fixed points is quantized, because you could imagine that you've got some line of inequivalent fixed points, this may be with the same values of eta star, but that's just the fact that eta star itself is quantized immediately tells you you expect a severe restriction on the number of fixed points that you have.
Very good.
Beyond that...
Because it's sort of curious, maybe without knowing that, but there aren't any examples, even in low dimensions, where there are piles and piles of fixed points in some theory space.
Yes, I mean, that's certainly plays important. In fact, it's all tied up, you know, I mentioned in this talk, these exactly marginal operators, and this is all tied up with it. So you always find in the exact logic, again, where you can do things in scalar field theory, where you can really see what's going on, that every fixed point, every critical fixed point, comes as a line of equivalent ones. In other words, you can go from one representative to the another by a local field definition. And this is intimately tied up with the quantization of eta star. And I should add one further thing. So a crucial ingredient to get quantization of eta star is that you assume that your actions are sufficiently local. So if you were to abandon locality, then you get a nightmare in theory space. Suddenly you get precisely what you were suggesting, some vast, you know, uncountable number of fixed points. And as long as you restrict the locality, then it seems that there are strong restrictions on what you can have. And just to add one thing about this, I mean, my hope, and I don't know whether it will be realized or not, is that this picture of considering the source-dependent extensions of one fixed point, it would be very nice and somewhat natural in some sense. This gives you further information about the whole structure of theory space. It might give a new way to start trying to probe some of these questions.
Can I give a sum up? There's something I really didn't understand. With your claim that I can infer what are the correct sources to put in the theory.
So what do you mean by the sources? So you mean the J's or the operators?
The J's.
Oh, no, so the J's, I just throw a J in.
Yes.
And then I find a solution. So I put a J in, and I find by solution some T star. Find J's, and these are in my dimensionless variables. Mm-hmm. I then translate back to dimension full variables and look at what happens in the ultraviolet. And then, for example, I find that this reduces to J dot phi.
Yeah, but presumably, whatever kind of source I have in the ultraviolet, I will get some T star of phi and curly J, no?
Ah, you mean if you put
J phi squared or J phi?
There might not be a solution corresponding to that. I mean, if you have such a solution, that tells you that an arbitrary number of insertions of that operator are non-determinatively renormalizable. It's not obvious to me that that's necessarily the case. I want to put the renormalizability in first, find what the solutions are to that, and then infer what the correlation functions that they correspond to.
So do you expect, for instance, in the 5-4 theory, the perturbation gives you J phi to be the only one which respects the criterion?
No, I think it depends on the dimension. So, in fact, something I'm looking at the moment is if you go below 4 dimensions, then it seems you should be able to include a phi squared term, I think. Mm. But that's work in progress. I wouldn't want to make any definitive statements about that. But I certainly expect the spectrum of allowable solutions, and hence the spectrum of the operators that you couple in the ultraviolet, to depend on the dimension.
Are there other questions? So let's say in Bolivar again.